promise you, we will win Iowa and we will win this election. And we'll remind the world why this is the greatest nation on earth. God bless you and God bless America.
Boston Red here with Friday Java, a weekly magazine of political theory, polling, and commentary. It is part of the Boston Red family, and for the hundreds of thousands of people that have joined us over the last 4 years in an exciting period in history called the election of Barack Obama, we introduce you to the final phase, the re-election campaign, two theories, pundits, people that make up this fascinating journey. We are part of the Obama Network. For that, we make no apologies. What we pledge to do is give you the facts on a bridge to history, what body politics is, the most up-to-date theories of political science and psychology. Stay tuned for this incredible ride. Boston Red, peace out. This is Friday Java for the 8th day of March 2013. Boston Red here. Our system has changed a little bit, so bear with us here as far as that is going. We'll go immediately to some world events, and we'll get back to the American political scene. We have a press release here from the Democratic Republic of Korea. The title of it is Second Korean War is Unavoidable. This is from the DPRK, their foreign ministry spokesman. From Pyongyang. The U.S. is now working hard to ignite a nuclear war to stifle the DPRK. Key resolutions and the Eagle joint military exercises kick off by the U.S., putting the situation on the Korean Peninsula on the brink of war. Maneuvers for nuclear war aim to mount preemptive strikes on the DPRK. The U.S. is massively deploying armed forces for aggression, including nuclear carrier task force strategic bombers, enough to fight a nuclear war under the smokescreen of annual drills. What should not be overlooked is that the war maneuvers are tied to coincide with moves to fabricate new resolutions at the United Nations Security Council against the Democratic Republic of Korea, pursuant to war scenarios of the U.S. to ignite a nuclear war under the pretext of nuclear non-proliferation. It is a war method of the U.S. to cook up a resolution at the Security Council to justify its war of aggression and unleash it under the berets of the UN force. They're referring to the green berets that, the blue berets that UN types wear. This is why the U.S. is huddling into war maneuvers. Every armed force of its satellite countries which participated in the past Korean War as UN forces. That was 60 years ago. After directing the strategic pivot for world hegemony to the Asian Pacific region, the U.S. regards it as a primary goal to put the whole of Korea Peninsula under its control in a bid to secure a bridgehead for landing in the Eurasian continent. It also seeks ways out of a serious economic crisis at home and unleash the Second Korean War. The U.S. is indeed the very criminal threatening global peace and security as it is staging dangerous war drills in this region, the biggest hotspot in the world, and a nuclear arsenal where nuclear weapons and facilities are densely deployed. The DPRK was so far made every possible effort while exercising maximum self-restraint in order to defend the peace and stability of the Korean Peninsula in the region. The U.S., however, responding to the DPRK's goodwill and self-restraint with large-scale nuclear maneuvers and the annual war drills are developing into a real war. Under this circumstance, the opportunity of diplomatic resolution has disappeared, and there remains only military counteraction. The spokesman for the foreign ministry states as followed: upon authorization as regards the grim situation that was created on the nuclear peninsula, seriously threatening the sovereignty of the country and its right to exist. First, now, the U.S. is set to light a fuse for nuclear war. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of the DPRK will exercise rights of a preemptory strike to destroy the stronghold of the aggressor and to defend the supreme interests of the country. The Supreme Command of the Korean People's Army declared that it would totally nullify the Korean Armistice Agreement from 11 March when the U.S. nuclear forces rehearse, so it gets into full swing. This means that from that moment, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of the DPRK will take military action for self-defense against any target, any movement not restrained by the armistice. Second, the force for adopting a resolution on sanction against the DPRK being backed by the U.S. at the Security Council will compel the DRK to take at an earlier date more powerful and second and third countermeasures as it has declared. The U.N. Security Council giving the green light to the U.S., it moves from a war of aggression against the DRP of adopting new resolution sanctions. It will fully display the might of that it's built up for decades of Sungun after decades and put to an end the evil cycle of tension. Third, given that it has been difficult to avert the Second Korean War, the DPRK strongly warned the Security Council not to take any further big blunders like the one in the past when it earned the gauge of the Korean nation by acting as a war servant for the U.S. in 1950. That was 60 years ago. The Security Council should immediately call into question the U.S. DPRK target nuclear rehearsals that pose a serious threat to global peace, security, and immediately disband the U.N. command, which is a tool for exercising U.S. War of aggression, and take measures for ending the state of technical war. Justice can be defended only when strength is reacted with strength and nuke with nuke. Should the U.S. ignite a war in this end, it will cause the flames of justice to flare up like an erupting volcano in which the aggressor will perish and curse military demarcation line disappear for good. The cursed demarcation line. That was from the Korean Foreign Ministry. They sent that out. So that effectively means the armistice that was been enforced the last 60 years, because technically the two Koreas are still at war. So thus we see this bringing its ugly head up. Also today, the funeral of Comandante Hugo Chavez in Caracas will occur, and we are covering that, and we will have more on the week that was, which is our weekend recap of events of the week. And any other special programming that we need to bring about. So we'll sort of skip around here and we'll go to the center at the University of Virginia. That's Larry Sabato and his crystal ball operation. This is by Alan Aberwitz. He's from the Emory University. Why Section 5 is still needed, racial polarization and the Voting Rights Act in the 20th Century is his title. Last week, the Supreme Court held oral arguments in the latest challenge to what many consider the most important civil rights law of the past century, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The challenge involves Section 5 of the law, which requires 9 states, all but 2 in the South, to obtain prior approval from the Justice Department before implementing any changes in voting law regulations and procedures. The Act, including Section 5, was last renewed in 2006. At the time, overwhelming majorities of Democrats and Republicans in both House and Senate. Scalia talks about this, to renew the law for 25 years based on extensive evidence, continued attempts to suppress, dilute the vote of racial and ethnic minorities in states covered by Section 5. Despite the legislative record, the judge's questions and comments during last week's oral argument suggest that there's a good chance that the court will vote to strike down Section 5. 5 conservative justices on the court, including Roberts, were clearly skeptical about continuing the need for federal supervision in the states covered by Section 5. At one point, Roberts asked whether the citizens of the South were more racist than citizens of the North. Roberts' question goes directly to what appears to be the central issue in the case, the continual significance of racial prejudice among white voters and political leaders in the states covered by Section 5. The officials bringing the suit to overturn Section 5 and their conservative allies claim that racial prejudice has diminished to the point where federal supervision of state and local governments in the covered states is no longer justified. In support of this argument, they cite victories of numerous African-American candidates for state and local office and increased turnout among African-American voters. There is no doubt that old-fashioned racism has greatly diminished over 40 years throughout the nation and in states covered by Section 5. However, there is good reason to be concerned about decisions to overturn Section 5, which affect the voting rights of African Americans and other minorities in these states. For reasons that are more political than racial, that's because regardless of whether white politicians in the states hold racist views, they have substantial political incentives for engaging in actions to suppress or dilute the minority vote. Racial profiling and the Voting Rights Act. In addition to a history of discrimination, the states covered by Section 5 are characterized by an exceptionally high degree of racial polarization in voting up to present day. Whites and non-whites in these states are deeply divided on their political preferences, resulting in two-party system in which one party depends overwhelmingly on the vote from whites and the other party overwhelmingly on votes from African Americans and non-whites. This racial polarization continues to provide a powerful incentive for leaders of the party that depends overwhelmingly on a white vote to suppress, dilute the votes of African Americans and other minorities. Racial profiling in voting can be measured by the difference in real racial composition of electoral coalitions that support the two major parties, provided evidence from the exit polls of 2008 concerning the degree of racial polarization in the states covered by Section 5. Compared with the rest of the nation, I use the presidential vote to measure polarization, but the results from the U.S. House votes were identical, and I use the data from 2008 because it's the most recent presidential election for which we have exit polling data that's available for analysis. However, it's almost certain that the results of 2012 would show at least as much racial polarization in there. Now, we look at the Section 5 states, the Democrat GOP vote, 38% Democratic, 89% voted for the GOP, that's with whites in those states, African Americans, 42% voted Democrat, 1% GOP. We don't know about them. Other non-whites, 20% voted Democrat, 10% GOP. That's in those states. Now, the rest of the nation, 65% of whites voted Democrat, 90% voted GOP voters. And African Americans, Democratic voters were 19%. This is the rest of the nation, and 1% GOP, and other non-white Latinos, etc. 16% were Democratic voters, 9% were GOP voters. The five states, Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia. And these are tables, and I'll put these up, show that there's a large difference in racial composition, Democratic and Republican electoral coalitions in both states covered by Section 5 and the rest of the nation. However, the difference in states was greater due to both the large non-white share of the overall electorate and the greater tendency of whites to vote for Republican candidates in these states. Only 24% of whites in the covered states voted for Barack Obama, compared with 48% of whites in the rest of the country. African Americans and other non-whites make up 10% of the Republican electoral vote coalition in both sets of states, with African Americans making up 1% of the Republican vote in both sets of states. But African Americans and non-whites make up 62% of the Democratic electoral coalition in covered states versus only 35% in the rest of the country. Greater concentration there. And let's see. Democratic candidates in the covered states are more dependent on African-American votes. This has been the case in Louisiana for a very long time, before Katrina and the destruction of New Orleans. Things have changed there. In addition to this difference in racial polarization, another key difference between the two sets of states, that is, the covered states are now dominated by the Republican Party. All nine covered states currently have Republican governors, Republican majorities in their legislatures. This means that political leaders in these states have powerful incentives to suppress, dilute the vote of African Americans and minorities, because these groups make up the largest majority of Democratic electoral base in their states. Moreover, as a majority party, they also have the ability to enact laws and regulations to accomplish the goal. Recent history shows that Republican leaders in states covered by the Act, that includes incidentally Alaska and the Aboriginals there, frequently attempt to suppress, dilute minority votes through actions such as enacting voter ID laws, the new Jim Crow, changing voting dates, changing poll locations, replacing partisan elections with nonpartisan elections. We've seen that increasingly also in California. And the instant runoff in places like San Francisco and in the Midwest city of Minneapolis, these are races to the core. While such actions have occurred in other states, the evidence collected by Congress in 2006 showed that they occur more frequently in the states covered on the five. The implications for the future: non-white share of electoral vote in states covered by Section 5 expected to increase over the next few decades, given the racial polarized pattern of votes for these states as a result of a political incentive for Republican leaders to pursue changes in election laws and regulations in order to suppress and dilute, making a continual review critical in those states. So this is basically from the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, and Professor Dr. Amowitz at Emory University, his interpretation. So that goes to the important factor involving in the American body politic. It is a continual situation. Also, let me make a note while I'm moving on here. We're having to reschedule. We're just running a little bit late here. We were scheduled to go up at 4 o'clock Eastern Time. We'll go at 4:30. Won't mean anything to people other than you will just hear us later in our live incarnation of the broadcast as we move along here. And we are changing that now, and I'll wait till it changes. in the Senate out of the state of Michigan. Carl Levin, who has been around for many years, will not run for re-election. He will is 79 now. He'd be 80, and what, he'd be 85 or so. So this leaves a number of people that will not be running for re-election in the Senate. Tom Harkin out of Iowa comes to heart there. Senator Lautenberg out of the state of New Jersey. And Rockefeller out of West Virginia. So there's a number of those will not be back. So 2014 will be an interesting situation as far as who the candidates are in the election. So we'll see how that shapes up. Michigan's one of those surprising states. Of course, he's 78. I thought he was 79. He's Armed Services Committee Chair, so it means a lot of things politically to the state when he leaves. So keeping Michigan blue will obviously be one of their goals for the Democratic Committee. His approval, this is from PPP out of North Carolina. His approval rating was at 45% in their automated disapproval at 37%. Wouldn't pay much attention to that. Carl Levin has ran a number of campaigns in the state of Michigan. The challenges that he would have, well, Justin Amash by 15 points, 49 to 34, Representative Kansas Miller by 11 points, leads Rogers by 16, and so forth and so on. Next year, Republican Governor Snyder will need to face governors. He's underwater right now, no doubt about that. Snyder in Michigan with the right to work. So there's a bunch of things going on around here. In what he decides to do. Evidently, and his brother also, Sander Levin, is a ranking member on the House Ways and Means Committee. He, of course, plans to run next year. One of the things is his continual running. And as we mentioned earlier, there's Rockefeller in West Virginia, Tom Harden, Harkin, and Lautenberg, that is three right there, and Tim Johnson out of South Dakota will probably retire. And on the Republican side, there's Saxby Chambliss, but he's in the state of Georgia, and Mike Johannes of Nebraska, that's a Republican state. So it'll be interesting to see where this particular situation is going. Last night we talked about, in fact, the title of the episode was The Filibuster. This Rand Paul character is thinking about a bid in 2012. He's going to take over the, evidently, the ceremonial libertarian position of his father, Ron Paul of Lake Jackson, Texas, who retired. Out of the state of Michigan, we'll just go over a few things here while we got the time. Lisa Madigan, she is the Attorney General there, and she was going in the bidding for Senator then Senator Barack Obama's position. So it would be interesting to see where she goes this time. A campaign for governor. Now, this Pat Quinn, his ratings are way, way down there, and her father is a very powerful politician in Chicago. So we'll see. That's in 2014 there. This again, PPP released a survey last number showing Madigan leading Quinn by 44 points. Well, that is an interesting situation, but the Illinois-based poll We Ask America found in January that Madigan also led in a three-way race, taking 30% of the vote versus 20% for Quinn, 15% for Dealey. Now, this is Dealey's brother they're talking about here that was in the White House, not the former mayor of Chicago, Dealey. But Madigan, basically a Chicago politician, her father is. So downstate, there used to be some problems, but a lot of that was solved by the candidacy of Barack Obama. So we're probably in a situation where the party there in Illinois is in better shape than it used to be in, no doubt about that. We also found out that the reason that Rand Paul's little debate lasted, I think, 13 hours, was he had to take a bathroom break, and he literally was too incompetent to do it properly. Usually somebody stands in, and that happened with Strom Thurmond. What Thurmond had done was he dehydrated himself, so he only took one bathroom break during his quote-unquote filibuster. So that was sort of the end of that. Also, Violence Against Women's Act has finally been signed by President Obama. We'll just sort of skate over it. The signing there of it finally did occur. He put the ink on it, so to speak, when it passed both the House and the Senate. There were problems with the Republicans in the House. The Senate, there was not that problem at all. In the state of Connecticut, new gun law there, that's in a poll that's out. There's a lot of polling going on out here. And a nice picture here in Politico. 93% of the voters support universal background checks. That's Lindsey Graham and company are coming with something very similar to that. And 68% support expansion of the state's assault weapon ban. 63% want to limit handgun purchases to one a month. People buying more than one a month is a very suspicious situation anyway. And that was 1,000 people basically in that. And that's a Quantific University poll there in the Northeast. They are a preemptive polar in that particular area as there. So to recap things, we have Hugo Chavez's funeral in Caracas. His body, incidentally, will lie in state in a military, old military barracks, and he'll be embalmed very similar to V.I. Lenin in the old Soviet Union. He's still there. In Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta has a narrow lead there with about a fourth of the vote to be counted. They had some computer problems there in Kenya. The Al Jazeera has the Democratic Republic of Korea to end peace pact with the South. That's called the armistice. In the 50s, that was a very, very talked about situation, the armistice, the war that was in the 50s during the Eisenhower administration. There and also the end of it. And of course, the reason that the war ended there at the 33rd parallel was that the United Nations forces, which had the U.S. in that, were fighting the Koreans and the Chinese, and they were winning the war, and that's where the war literally stopped. That was the end of things right there, and that is where they are now. In fact, Phnom Penh is about where the DMZ is, about 60 miles outside of Seoul. So it's a very close proximity there as far as to where it is. Let me just grab a little bit of financial stuff here. We did have a little bit of financial stuff. from the Reuters news agency. Google, incidentally, is cutting 1,200 jobs. That's at Motorola Mobility. That they bought that particular enterprise as one of the things going around here. But otherwise, the economy seems to be moving along. Job gains have boosted the economy, no doubt about that. And just quickly looking at the markets, the Dow is at 14,329.49. Today, the S&P 500 was at 1,544.62. And the NASDAQ was at 3,232, whatever that means to you. But nonetheless, it was up today 33.25. That's the Dow Jones. The gold was up, let's see, $3.40. Oil rest at $91.59. And corn was up $1.50. So we always like to see those happen. We'll be here at the Dealing on Numbers, man. We'll feature some business economists at their convention in Washington. Janice Yellen will have a little bit of what she had to say. And also economist Finkel, Dr. Finkel, has been with several organizations, including the Israeli Financial Organization. So we'll hear from him, a more of an international perspective on what's going on. And of course, Janet Yellen, she is vice chair of the Federal Reserve. Now, the job report, February job report, this is expected to add 160,000 jobs, picking up slightly from 157,000. This has been pretty much what's been going on here. And that'll be out at, what is it, 8 a.m. Eastern time. So we'll have that on Numbers, man, that complete information. This does it for Friday Jobber. Boston Radio, have a good weekend. We'll talk to you on the week that was. And on the Monday Morning Quarterback. And incidentally, before we forget here, we have a World Baseball Tournament going on. And it's in several localities. Fidel Castro has been twittering about it. We'll get it in a minute here. Oh, oops, we had to go here. Actually, okay, this is Thursday, in Tokyo, the Netherlands, of all people, beat Cuba 6-2. Venezuela lost 3-9 over Dominican Republic. That was in Puerto Rico. And in Phoenix, Arizona, Pool D. Who won that? Italy over Mexico. This is actually baseball. You'd think it'd be more soccer. So it goes on, and we'll have more of this on the Monday Morning Quarterback as far as the World Baseball Classic. So we had the first round and some of the second round there, and various other people that are in this. Dominican Republic's in there, Puerto Rico, Italy, Canada, the U.S., Mexico was in it. So the first round, so second round today. Japan actually plays today. They play Taiwan. So we'll look there and get baseball scores. Not only we got spring training going on, but we got that. A quick look at the Boston Red Times. You have something from Russell Simmons at Bloomberg and his gun controls out there. And closing the digital divide, that's from the Pew people. We'll talk about that later, Latinos and technology adoption. And, of course, from Arizona, the Comandante Hugo Chavez. Some of the things going on. And protecting internet access for rural Georgians. That's from Color of Change. They want you to send to representatives. We'll get maybe more of that on a week. It was, we'll take a quick look at it now. We got some time there. Western Stream and AT&T don't want to bring high-speed internet to Georgia's black rural communities. There's probably no doubt about that. And they have here is a letter to send to your representatives, to your members of the House. The simply titled Municipal Broadband Investment Act would do nothing of the sort. That is HB 282. Rather than investing in the long-promised network bailout vital to Georgia's economic development, the telecoms are investing lobbying resources into outlawing competition from cities and towns. This has been something we talked about on the open source report. We had something on wireless as some rural communities have been largely abandoned. That happens all over the nation. And HB2 is a rehash of last year's SB 313, in turn drawn from the model municipal broadband pushed by ALEC. ALEC has literally got their hands in broadband in state houses across the nation. And what's happened here, in many of these states, they have forbid the cities from having their own municipal networks, which is talking about treasonous. That is treasonous to the citizenry. We heard some right winger talk about the Fed, and Dr. Bernanke should be tried for treason. This is much more important. Nonetheless, we're out of here. And as a poor laureate of Newark, New Jersey, hadn't heard the Twitter King, would say, one L.A. Bill Graham, peace out. Good day.